And finally, the title of the work is the Vajra Chedika Prajnaparamita Sutra. So what does this mean? Vajra, the first part of the word, means both diamond and thunderbolt. And the diamond or the thunderbolt occupies a quite important place in Buddhist symbolism. It also gives its name to one of the three great phases of the development of Buddhism in India. First, as you know, came the Hinayana, the little vehicle, then the Mahayana, the great vehicle, and then the Vajrayana, the vehicle, the path or the way of the diamond or the thunderbolt. And in Buddhist symbolism, in Buddhist thought, the Vajra, the diamond or the thunderbolt, connotes something of irresistible strength, irresistible potency, something capable of pulverizing, something capable of smashing, of shattering everything that stands in its way. And Chedika means that which cuts, or it means a cutter. So we can now understand the meaning of the full title of the Diamond Sutra, the Vajra Chedika Prajnaparamita Sutra. It means the sutra, or the discourse, on the transcendental wisdom that cuts like the thunderbolt, or cuts like the diamond. And this in turn gives us a clue to the meaning and the significance of the whole of the sutra itself. To begin with, the sutra is, by very definition, by virtue of the fact that it is termed a sutra, it is the word of the Buddha, what we call Buddha Vachana, the word or the utterance of the Buddha, the enlightened one. That is to say, the Diamond Sutra is the expression, is an expression of the enlightened mind. It doesn't come from the ordinary mind, doesn't come from the brain, doesn't come from the logical mind, doesn't come from the lower consciousness, doesn't come from any mundane, any conditioned consciousness. The Diamond Sutra is the expression of the enlightened mind. And the enlightened mind is one with reality. The enlightened mind knows reality, sees reality face to face. So the Diamond Sutra, if you like, is a revelation, an exposition of reality itself. So that reading it, reflecting upon it, meditating upon it, bearing it in mind, we make contact. It may be through a thick veil, but we make contact, so far as we are able, with reality. And when we make that contact through the Diamond Sutra with reality, then the light of reality illumines the darkness of our hearts and the darkness of our minds. And as it illumines the darkness of our hearts and the darkness of our minds, there appears in this light, shining as it were, from reality through the Diamond Sutra into us, there appears transcendental wisdom. And though we compare this transcendental wisdom to, as it were, light, it's at the same time like a diamond, like a thunderbolt. This transcendental wisdom cuts through all our thoughts, cuts through all our ideas, all our concepts about reality. It cuts through, it destroys, it shatters all our negative emotions, our fear, our anxiety, our anger, our jealousy, our possessiveness, our craving, our clinging. It cuts through all our negative emotions. It cuts through all our psychological conditionings, our conditionings on account of belonging to this nationality, this race, speaking this language, living in this sort of environment, and so on. It cuts through all our psychological conditionings, all our prejudices, all our metaphysical assumptions. It smashes, in a word, this diamond, this thunderbolt of transcendental wisdom. It smashes everything conditioned, everything that is, that stands in between us and reality, in between us and the seeing of the truth face to face. And above all, we may say, this thunderbolt of transcendental wisdom smashes us as we at present know ourselves to be. When we, as we at present, experience ourselves, when we come into contact with that transcendental wisdom, then we feel its impact like a thunderbolt, as it were, smashing and destroying us. Now this, if one begins to think about it, if one begins to feel it, now this is a very terrible thing. I remember that D.H. Lawrence, in one of his poems, says, "It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. They are so large, and they cradle so much of a man." Let me just read them again. "It is a fearful thing," he says, "to fall into the hands of the living God." Not the dead God, the living God. "They are so large, and they cradle so much of a man." Not Lawrence, being a poet, expresses the matter theistically, since that was his natural idiom, as it were, but we can paraphrase that first line, "It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God," we can paraphrase it in more Buddhistic terms, perhaps more truly, and we can say that it's a fearful thing. We can say it's a terrible thing to get caught in the grip of reality. It's a terrible thing to get caught in the grip of transcendental wisdom. It's a terrible thing to get caught even in the grip of the Diamond Sutra, because once you get caught, well, you're caught. You may wriggle and wriggle, but you can't get free. So the question arises, is one prepared for this? The question arises, does one want to get caught? Does one want to get caught, gripped by reality, by transcendental wisdom, by the Diamond Sutra? If we don't, then it's better to leave the Diamond Sutra alone. It's even better just to leave it on the shelf, collecting dust. If we don't want to get caught by the Diamond Sutra, it's even better just to walk out of the door now. But even if we do want to get caught, even if we're happy to get caught, eager to get caught, it's better to proceed very slowly and very cautiously. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. I've quoted these words more than once before, and I make no apology for quoting them again. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. And we certainly cannot bear very much of the Diamond Sutra. We can bear very little of it, in fact, if any of it. And this is why we are working our way into it, working our way into the subject, working our way into the Diamond Sutra very slowly. And in fact, as our chairman said, rather anticipating what I'm going to say, though he didn't know I was going to say it, there can be no question of giving a complete, a systematic exposition of the teaching of the Diamond Sutra in all its depth and all its breadth, even if such an exposition could be given, because probably there's not a single person in this room who could bear it. It would just be too much. If some Buddha or some Bodhisattva was to come along, was to appear in mid-air, as it were, and start expounding the Diamond Sutra in its fullness and really telling us what it was all about, then everybody would probably collapse in their chairs. Would have to be carried out, feet foremost. And if ever we were to get round, if ever we do get round to really talking about the Diamond Sutra, then I suggest that we need to have the St. John's Ambulance Brigade standing by. So meanwhile, we're going slowly and cautiously. We've understood the meaning of the title of the sutra, and this has given us some insight into the meaning and significance of the whole work. So we'll now have a look at the literary framework of the sutra. And after that, if we feel brave enough and venturesome enough, we may just take a quick glance at some of the major insights of the sutra.